The days passed like the cars of a speed freight. Valentine contrived to take Blake on a fishing trip. Sufficient dirt, an oversized droopy boat hat, and some baggy clothes made him into a lean boy whose arms and legs were finishing up a growth spurt. On his own, Valentine visited a little shrine near the old arch that he'd found on his first trip to the city. Years ago, his father had eliminated the Currians from St. Louis. He'd learned this not from his father, but from some other men who had served with him, and the Groggs set up their form of memorial in the lobby of what had been an elevator to the top of the monument. Some bits and pieces laid out in an arch of parachute silk that imitated the one above, bullet casings, a canteen, a K-bar-style knife, a climbing glove, and some nylon rope, he understood. But there was also a foxtail, a bunch of oddly shaped dice in a clear plastic tube, and a stoppered bottle of what looked like salad oil. It wasn't taboo for a grog to take them up for a moment's examination or obeisance, provided they were returned when the task was done. He was tempted to take the glove. Though it was larger than his own hand, it still seemed small when compared with his memories of his father's huge, capable ones.
Hey, you! Not too close!
Kutcher took him up to the riverbank's bluffs and showed him a house with a rambling basement cut into the limestone, lately occupied by a river trader who owned a wharfside sawmill and a bone-racking tubercular cough. In a fit of anxiety about his approaching death, he donated the property entire and its furnishings to the church.
One last tree, this time with God. May his bargain pay off.
They planned to move Blake as soon as the researchers from the Miskatonic did their last set of visual acuity tests. He'd have room to explore up there, in the moonless darkness under the trees. Kutcher said that keeping up with him would be good for his cardiovascular health. It felt wrong to say goodbye in a basement. Goodbyes were for front yards, garden gates, train platforms, and bus pickup corners, not shuttered basements that smelled like soaking diapers.
Narcisse, if you need more money.
Monsignor Kutcher has ample sources. We want for nothing.
Except the sight of one of those big palms.
Ah, royal palms. I do miss them. And the smell of morning wind off the sea.
I want to thank you again for...
David, please. I am old and have learned the difference between needed and used. Here, I am needed. Here, I talk long to the knights with a fine priest as we watch. A deep, kind man with the magic of the right hand. I have known only two or three other like him.
I wish I had time to find Blake some blocks, some early reader books.
Yeah, I will find or paint some Scrabble pieces, like the Ratbeats had. He will learn ABCs when he is ready. He'll learn, but his mind has not yet caught up to his body.
Valentine regretted the lost Mahjong pieces. Blake would probably enjoy the colors and intricate designs. Valentine's last reminder of the good days with Malia Carrasca were in some prison warehouse deep in the nut, probably. Narcisse gave him a bag of dried meat sticks, a bag of glazed biscuits, and some nuts mixed with oats and cornbread crumbs, the grog version of trail mix. He rolled one of the cheroot-sized tubes of meat. Narcisse could make even the spongiest legworm flesh taste like tenderloin medallions in a sauce, but he suspected this was pork.
You must not leave yet. I must press one last hug on you.
Valentine knelt down so she could hug him. Those mauled limbs that had first met around his neck on a sun-baked Haitian street pressed at either temple, pressed hard, as though trying to meet somewhere in his corpus callosum. She closed her eyes.
Lord, won't you put honeycomb on David's pot so his journey is sweet? There is too much bitter in him. Let it find its way out.
Narcisse had a talent for cryptic expression that sometimes rivaled that of the Life Weavers. Valentine wondered if he'd been cross with Blake or the Block brothers from the Miskatonic when he gave them their marching orders.
If only you could add a little molasses to me, the way you do the spoon bread.
You already look better. Go now or I cry some. Maybe I cry some anyway, but I don't want you around for that.
Valentine reckoned that 3 days of round-the-clock legworm travel would get him to Nancy's north of Tulsa. He'd made a deal with a driver from the Rabbit's Foot clan, whom he silently called Tic-Tac, because the grog's back-hide scars looked like a couple of drunks had started playing tic-tac-toe on it with hot knives. Which wasn't out of the realm of possibility. Captured grogs were sometimes cruelly treated to put the fear of man in them before they were released. Of course, captured men were often eaten when not enslaved, so cruelty was a matter of perspective. They took turns driving the beast through day and night, skirting the UFR. Valentine hoped that the unofficial truce of the Missouri brush that had settled in when he'd first become a cat was still holding, and that no wide-ranging patrols would risk a flare-up by potting what looked like a human small trader and his driver. Difficulty showed itself in a 6-man patrol.
Hold up!
Whoa!
3 challenged him, and 3 more waited, kneeling in the brush. 5 kids and a senior NCO. The kids were too young, and the NCO was grizzled right to the hair growing out of his ears. Valentine felt for the oldster, riding herd on a bunch of downy cheeks too young to know how easily they could die. But the Missouri bushwhack country would lend itself to give the kids some experience without the risks that went with the swamps around New Orleans, the open plains to the west, or the alley between Crowley's Ridge and Memphis. Valentine watched the rifles and picked out an escape route through the brush. If things looked bad, he'd topple off the legworm and run like a rabbit, twisting and turning across the mud through first spring flowers of the blackberry bramble.
Hey, freebies! You boys looking for a little joy juice to keep out the nightly chill?
Check out that chair. Quite a ride he has on that legworm.
The NCO's rifle dangled in its sling, but the officer kept his hand hooked casually in his Alice belt, close to the butt of his sidearm.
Just a friendly warning, stranger. You're about 10 miles out of a UFR settlement. They'll panic at the sight of a worm and open up on you.
Like a bunch of potato diggers could hit a legworm if it were on top of them.
Where are you bound for?
South of Kansas City, Kansas.
Top, he's traveling with a stoop. That puts him under suspicion. Stop and question.
Question away. I'd like an excuse to get off this damn worm. It's Tic-Tac here who's on tribal conference business. I just own the worm.
Tic-Tac rocked nervously in his saddle, his anxiety evident, but kept his hands away from his long single-shot varmint gun. Valentine doubted he even had any bullets for it. Instead, he had a grip on his sharp-hooked worm goad. Valentine hoped Tic-Tac wasn't getting any ideas about the worth of the kids' rifles and hair at the next tribal bragging session. If the kids knew just how quickly a grog could throw a balanced utility axe like the one dangling from its leather thong on the saddle hook, they'd be back another 10 yards or so. Valentine tried to will the kid into slinging the gun and losing interest in the encounter, but the boy had either imagination or a grudge against men out of the Groglands.
That's maybe a Kurian agent. He should be put under arrest.
Not another word, cadet. If that grog is a messenger, he'll die before he'll come out of that saddle. Then we'll have a feud with Rabbit's Foot and their allies.
Valentine's stomach sank. The kid was an officer candidate, looking to establish his record for initiative.
Bury and buckle up, Top. Come on.
And if he were a Kurian agent, we'd all be running to check out the sound of 70 legworms passing north of here. We're shooting at each other.
Valentine felt a gurgle in his stomach and took the opportunity to break the tension.
Woo! Never could handle those grog mushrooms.
Pass wind, friend. You're free to go ahead. Just stick to the west.
No worry. We'll be out of UFR lands by nightfall.
Safe travel.
Let's go!
The NCO pulled the boys out of the way of the legworm's antenna and nodded to Valentine as they passed. Valentine considered that the peacefully concluded meeting was an example of the differences between the Free Territory and the Kurian Zone. In the Free Territory, an NCO could use his judgment. In the KZ, they'd be kept waiting while the NCO called his officer, who called a higher officer, who would order them searched, and then, when they found nothing of interest, would call a higher officer still, who'd want to know why he was being bothered and ordered them released anyway. Provided there wasn't a reaper breathing down his neck with an appetite that made starting a feud with a grog tribe over a single wanderer's aura worth it. The kids who were covering from ambush stood up as they passed and gaped. On the third day, it took both of them together to keep their mount going. Legworms had astonishing reserves, but eventually even the digging goads would have no effect. Valentine let the grog have his legworm and rig. He also swapped Tic-Tac a half-empty tin of his foot powder for the grog's delicately carved ear-grooming stick. He felt no particular sympathy with Tic-Tac, but if this wasn't the longest trip the grog had ever been on, it was close. and he'd want something to point to when telling the story.
So long.
Valentine walked toward Nancy's oddly peaked roofs. They always reminded him of old Pizza Huts, taking the first of many steps westward. David Valentine first learned of Nancy's from his old tentmate, Lieutenant Caltagirone of Foxtrot Company. Nancy's had been a retirement home for Tulsa's well-to-do, who were unwilling to quit the rolling hill country of eastern Oklahoma. Its single-story, vaguely prairie school architecture was spread out over several acres, with a central hub and an outbuilding or two. In the Kurian zone, people were retired in much the same manner as an old worn-out tire, with the reapers serving as mechanics. But its layout made it a convenient rehabilitation center for quisling veterans. Nancy herself was something of a legend in the Nebraska Guard for her devotion to the maimed and shattered. She kept her charges busy with arts and crafts, which she sold in Tulsa at Curry and Patriotic festivals to buy a few luxuries. The Nancy's sticker became so famous that an art colony of sorts had sprung up in the area, with workers of metal, leather, wood, ceramics, and paint adding to the trade. Nancy's also had the best food in three states. Kurian Order and New Universal Church dignitaries often spent long weekends visiting the home and enjoying the cuisine as they got their picture taken, shaking hands with the more photogenic of the wounded. It seemed the last place one would expect to be a warehouse for the resistance. When the Kurians heard the occasional whisper or screamed confession that Nancy's had been the place guerrillas got their explosives, they assumed that their prisoners had been coached into fingering the establishment in the hope that the whole staff would be swept up in a purge. The routine searches revealed nothing. Of course, they didn't remove the wounded from their thick, comfortable, bleach-scented bedding, pillowcases lined with gleaming rows of decorations. Only the laundry staff, under careful supervision of senior nurses, ever changed the bedding. Nancy's had grown since the last time Valentine visited as a tired and hungry lieutenant trying to supply his men scouting the Kurian zone. The Kurian pillar, he remembered, breaking the horizon like a white needle, now had a cross openly displayed upon it, and the trees had spread their shade over the windows and doors. The vegetable gardens and stands of tomato vines had multiplied and spread to both sides of the road that met the old interstate a couple of miles south. New houses, mostly two- or three-room shotgun shacks, built around a common well pump, circled the grounds like campers keeping warm at a fire. A red-painted market that Valentine had remembered being a livestock barn promised fuel, food, lodging, thanks to a blue-and-white sign salvaged from the interstate. To the southwest, behind a small hill, birds circled the community trash heap. No distance seemed too great for gulls to travel in search of garbage. A few hardy souls were out on the blustery day, mostly working in the vegetable patches or trying to dry laundry under the eaves. Some muddy kids and dogs chased one another through the culverts at the roadside. Valentine worked at the caked-up grime on his face and hands, and then turned up toward the main entrance of the hub. "We're full," a repainted folding yellow caution sign told him. Inside the entry vestibule, a 6-foot panel of plywood served as a local notice board, along with advertisements for watchdogs, guaranteed to bark at hoods, and ironmongery and the weekly swap meet and different flavors of Bible study were dozens of messages giving names and destinations, probably of refugees from the destruction in Tulsa. Valentine scanned them until he found what he wanted, a note from Duvalier employing her usual brevity. "Black. I'm in Comfort 18. Red." Allie had written their old nicknames from the trip across Tennessee and Kentucky. A faint pang of regret at their parting. She'd insisted he was crazy for harboring Blake. Jury's still out on that one. Valentine stepped into the old reception area of the nursing home. The tile of the vestibule gave way to cool, homey brick within. Two armed men wearing five-pointed stars played cards at a round wooden table, rifles and shotguns placed across a pair of ottomans with a sleeping mutt between. A wide reception window looked out on the doors and waiting area, and behind it, a disarmingly young teenage girl sat writing on a pad. Something about Valentine caused the security's antenna to twitch, and they gave him a long, careful look as he approached the girl.
"I'm looking for Comfort 18.
Down the hall."
"Much obliged."
Valentine gave a friendly nod to the constabulary. He risked a glance back as he found the appropriate hall, and noted that they'd left their cards to watch him. Valentine smelled barbecue and laundry soap and disinfectants, sharp odors of chlorine and borax. A new universal church hostel smelled much the same, albeit with potatoes and cabbage substituted for the barbecue. Someone had brought in blue bonnets and red bud for the vases at the hallway intersections, adding color and aroma. He thought them a nice touch. Four-color propaganda posters provided the only color in NUC lodgings. The halls were wide for the accommodation of hospital gurneys. Now, spare cots stood in the halls and the little social rooms used by the patients. Children played in the halls, racing toys on the smooth flooring, or hard at work with blocks, Legos, and tinker toys. Valentine found Duvalier's room. Its door stood open.
The young ladies in this room are either at the clothes swap or the bar.
A matronly woman in one of the cheery embroidered staff aprons chewed on the inside of her cheek for a moment as she looked him over. He noted the frame of a cart behind.
There's gaming and music and storytelling for those who like wasting good daylight.
Thank you.
They said a tall man with straight black hair would be coming. You shining on one of those gals? Or are you already married up?
Not exactly.
Then there's something wrong with you. Sweet things. They shouldn't be unprotected.
If the other sweet thing was Moira Stiakowski, the pair needed as much protection as a pair of ornery wolverines.
Thank you. Clothing swap?
The big green aluminum barn to the north.
Right. Or bar.
It's not on Nancy's property. I never met a man who couldn't find a bar his own self. The owner's name is Trumpet.
Trumpet. Thank you, ma'am.
You can thank me by handing me that water pitcher. The stuff from the tap is strictly wash water, unless you're a local and used to it.
Valentine held it for her while she filled it from a set of big plastic jugs on her cart. Valentine wandered to the clothing swap first and found the cavernous barn filled with odds and ends from darned socks to snappy but stained felt hats. A giant iron-bottomed laundry pot bubbled over charcoal and filled the whole barn with a faint smell of lye. More women and children sat on folding chairs or fruit boxes, talking and sewing.
Offering, trading, or needing?
Just looking.
Valentine hadn't seen a bar coming into Nancy's, so he made for the other end of her property. Sure enough, some entrepreneur had taken an old buffet franchise resting just on the other side of the hill from the garbage pit and turned it into a sawdust and fat lamp saloon. A tarnished trumpet hung from the sign outside. A few biodiesel pickups, several bicycles, and some wagon teams were arranged outside with shade given to the animal transport and proximity to the door taken by the bikes. The pickup trucks were parked facing the road to give passersby a good look. One driver had even popped his hood to show off chrome exhaust pipes and a supercharger. Valentine pushed open the carpet remnant strip that acted as a windbreak. Valentine smelled fryer oil and kidney-filtered beer. As soon as his eyes adjusted, he picked out Duvalier in what would have been a crowd if everyone weren't spread out as though trying to keep out of one another's business. He walked past tables with cards and dominoes and guns being examined for trade or sale. A pair of women worked behind the bar, serving drinks and making sandwiches. Lounging in a wooden high-walled booth, Duvalier was in her usual earth-toned, free territory clothing, her knife-cut red hair dirty and disarranged. She'd put a good deal of effort into making herself look less attractive than she was, wrapped up in the duster that hid her body from the neck down. Valentine didn't recognize the young woman with her, noted only that she was blonde with a longish face and nose. Duvalier pointed for the benefit of her companion, and Valentine took in the blonde's wide-set, steady eyes. Then she blushed and dropped her gaze.
Three satyrs over here. Blackie, this is Jules. Be nice. She's like a sister to me.
Public code for another cat. Valentine wondered what her real name was.
Max Argent.
Bad news, looks like. Your shipment's delayed. Em is still getting it together.
Valentine wondered at that. Lambert could take a plane for a rendezvous with a potential operative, but they couldn't get a footlocker of gear to the edge of what amounted to the Free Territory? United Free Republic, he reminded himself.
I hope you weren't planning to meet a train.
Valentine wondered at Jules' accent. It sounded distant. She must not have operated in the KZ much, or she would know how to smother it. It attracted too much attention.
No, I dropped word at Hobarth's that I'm looking to pass west.
Not as a driver, I hope, given your abilities behind the wheel.
Scout work, security, maintenance, whatever they need. There'll be westbound convoys for a month or two.
I'll leave tonight to let Moira know you've arrived. You can have my bed.
Valentine waited for a remark about staying in it. Duvalier treated his cocksmanship as something of a joke, which it was, considering the results.
Traveling at night?
It's almost as quiet as the Ozarks around here nowadays. Nearest organized Kurians are 100 miles away, west and north.
It won't be a problem.
In the last 3 years, the Great Plains had been transformed into a bloody quilt of territories in revolt and those still under the Kurians. Grogs and mercenaries from as far away as inland China were holding on to North America's breadbasket. Duvalier paid for the ciders and cigarettes, one of the lower denominations in a ranking that went thus: gold, batteries, whiskey, ammunition, tobacco. Lesser necessities like darning thread, pens, gloves, and toothbrushes also served as unofficial currency, from Kurian zone to freehold and back again, if someone was running short and could be talked into a swap. Valentine learned that Jules hailed from a privileged family in Iowa. Her father owned an estate that sounded similar to the one he'd visited in search of F.A. James. She'd spent her teenage years out east at school and returned to the usual privileged child's choice of military, church, or management career. She ran away, just in time to get caught up in Consul Solon's bid to put the Trans-Mississippi under the Kurians.
I tried to join the guerrillas, but since I wasn't anybody's cousin or sister-in-law, I couldn't find out anything about where they were hiding. When the strike speech came, I didn't get to hear it, but I saw it on a leaflet. I didn't know what else to do, so I started a fire in a tire pile outside a TMCC garage. Some janitors were executed for it.
Don't put it like that. The Kurian Order executed, not you.
I did a bunch of other stuff. Punctured tires at night. I learned how to cut a hot electrical wire. Stuff where I could do a little damage quietly and then run away.
A girl after my own heart.
I take it she never went through our little ceremony.
Nope.
Valentine looked at the scar on his palm, barely distinguishable from legworm hook hardened skin. Jules looked down, hiding under her hair. What did the girl have to be ashamed of? It wasn't her fault the Life Weavers had disappeared. For one awful second, Valentine wondered if she was a Kurian agent, slowly digging her way into Southern Command. No, Duvalier was a good judge of character. You didn't walk up and apply to be a cat. The cats found you. After the evening meal, Duvalier disappeared. In all the time Valentine had known her, she'd rarely been an initiator of goodbyes. Like a careful extra in a stage play, she liked to make unobtrusive appearances and disappearances. Probably why she still had blood in her veins after all these years in and out of the Kurian zone. As night fell, people filtered back into the connected buildings and gathered around the tiny charcoal stoves on the grounds that provided heat for cooking and boiling laundry. The talkative in the refuge discussed either Tulsa, when it would finally be cleared so people could return to see what was left of their lives, or the possibilities of finding work far from the fighting in Texas or Arkansas. Then there were the doomsayers.
They'll be back. No such thing is safe. Scorched earth, the order said. And just because the flame ain't touched you yet, doesn't mean it's not burning.
Even in the facility's new role as improvised refugee squat, Valentine had to admire the cleanliness of the rooms, painted in an institutional color he called muted lime. The medicine cabinet in the shared bathroom held a couple of tonics for Duvalier's on-again, off-again stomach problems, antiseptic ointments, and a thermometer. The only disappointment was the ashy-tasting toothpaste. They went to their individual beds with lights out. Nancy's had its own generators, but fuel for them had to be conserved. Valentine hid under a sheet, a little ashamed of the state of his underclothes. Maybe a visit to the swap was in order after all. Jules produced a bottle of curry and rum, and they passed it back and forth.
Another swig, Valentine?
No, never take more than a couple out here. You should be careful with alcohol in the KZ. They say a little helps cut life sign by relaxing you. Whether it's true or no, I'd rather be alert.
This isn't the Kurian zone. Not anymore.
Though Jules asked, Valentine didn't want to talk about the rising in Little Rock. Instead, he shifted the conversation to their childhoods. He told her a little about growing up in Minnesota. To an Iowan, nothing but hairy, thick-blooded barbarians lived north of Rochester, and in between swallows, she painted a picture of the privileged life of a ringwinner's daughter.
I was supposed to go into the church. I was a youth vanguard leader, of course. Then it was army, church, or industry. Since Ving Jr. went army and Kirby got her master's in production, we had that dried-up old prune of a priest sitting me down for improvement, effort, humility, care, and acceptance. Man in his unnatural state. Spiritual recycle. Can't believe how much of that crap I remember. Didn't even try to learn it, but I can still recite the truths, word for word.
Valentine listened to her breathing until he too drifted away. He woke, a little, when she got up to use the bathroom. He woke further when she returned and slipped into his bed. She nuzzled his ear.
Object?
Ask a silly question.
Jewel's clean-smelling skin enticed Valentine as she continued nuzzling his ear. He felt an erect nipple against his tricep. She tested him with her grip. Her hand knew what it was doing.
Nice answer. Not a bit silly. Drop in.
Valentine recognized the Iowa-ism, but one Valentine had never heard breathed in his ear, only secondhand from guy talk over beers.
Not so fast.
Valentine began a series of kisses down her neck. He hadn't touched a woman in over a year. Might as well enjoy the opportunity. Spent, aroused, and spent again, Valentine slept deep and hard in the sweat and slickness of their lovemaking after she retreated to her bed.
What the hell was that?
Reapers.
Valentine could feel them. His old comrades in the wolves called it the Valentingle and trusted it more than Valentine did. Sometimes he could detect a Reaper with pinpoint accuracy. Other times, he could walk right over one without sensing it. Now they seemed to fill his whole mental horizon. Could be a dozen or more.
You have a weapon, Jules?
Beretta, bag on the chair.
Get it. Then get dressed.
Valentine retrieved his .45 ACP, the weight a calming comfort in his hand.
Drop life sign and...
I don't know how!
Reapers hunted using life sign, an energy created by the vital aura their masters desired. Humans produced more than livestock. Livestock produced more than crops. Valentine checked the window, saw a family hightailing it across the fields, each holding a child over a shoulder as they ran, a dog keeping worried circles. Over by the barn, a woman ran in the same direction. A shadow, moving so fast it seemed a trick of the eye, followed her across the field. It suddenly engulfed her. Valentine ran to the door to the hallway and shared bathroom.
Crouch, with both hands on the floor.
Valentine had been told that contact with the earth acted like the ground on a lightning rod, but he suspected it was bullshit. But it was a relaxing pose. You didn't feel as vulnerable as you would lying down. And there's the tendency to shift nervously when standing.
Picture your whole life folding up into a box.
They'll locate. They sense pregnant women best.
Emergency alert, code black multiple. Code black multiple.
What's that?
Never mind. Fold up pictures of your family, friends, memories, whatever, and put it in a mental box.
Stop!
I don't see.
Keep your eyes shut. What kind of flower do you like?
Flower?
Picture your favorite flower.
Daisy.
Great, a daisy. There's just a daisy, nothing else. Blackness and a daisy. It's a big one. You're keeping your eyes on the yellow center.
Yes.
Now it starts to spin slowly, like a windmill. Oh, so slowly.
Yes.
Never mind that. Speed the daisy up. It's spinning faster now. Slow it down now. Slower and slower and slower. Slower than that windmill. Slower than a second hand on a watch. Slow. Slow it so it's moving like a minute hand. You can barely see it. It's moving so slowly.
Valentine unwrapped a souvenir from his time with the Kentucky Worm Riders. It was a short, stout hand axe, blade tapering into a legworm hook. For Valentine, lowering life sign meant taking a big bright blue ball that represented his consciousness and slowly shrinking it to a point like a star, which he watched with all the concentration of an astronomer at a telescope eyepiece.
Keep watching the petals turn.
Valentine reached up and gripped a cami-wrapped handle from beneath his pillow and drew it close beside.
Turning. Turning.
Safe?
We are. They're not.
The old cat Everready got to be an old cat by hunting reapers only in the daylight, when their connection to their master was weakest, or after they fed, when they, or more accurately the master Kurian animating them, got dopey from the aura feed. The Valentingle weakened and diffused, throbbing on and off in his head like a bulb on fading current. Carnage was the only word for it. Bodies, some still twitching, lay in the hallway or had been flung across gurneys. Crushed necks and heads, mostly. Some bore wet blossoms on their shirts from punches that had caved in rib cages. Valentine followed the pointy, bloody boot prints down the hall and found the corpse of the teenage girl who checked him in at the desk folded around her broken armalite, her auburn hair bound up with a cheerful polka dot scrunchie. She had a hole at the base of her throat, paying for the insult of her 223 shells with coin drawn straight from the aorta. Valentine shut her glassy eyes, turned her on her back and straightened her, tenderly placed her heels together and her palms at her side, put her riven weapon on her chest, and covered her with a bedsheet from one of the gurneys. He walked toward the exit door at the end of the hall. The cool night air hit him like a slap, and like a slap, it brought him out of the moment's madness. He held the axe like a runner's baton in his left hand, pistol in his right. These weren't wild reapers, sometimes sent into the free territory to brutalize and maul, little dandelion seeds of chaos drifting where instinct took them. These reapers had gone through Nancy's quickly and methodically, trying to cram as much death into a given number of minutes as possible, which probably meant they had a long trip back, perhaps as far as Tulsa? Valentine's cat-sharp eyes picked out motion at the outbuildings, a reaper moving south, hopping from rooftop to rooftop as it tried to sense if any beings hid within. He sank to his knees.
Why?
Not much acting required for this. He searched the low spring clouds.
Why us?
Valentine covered his eyes, decided not to sob. There was such a thing as overdoing it. The Reaper didn't even bother to cut back so it could approach him from behind. It approached a little off-kilter, shifting this way and that, reaching too far with its lower limbs, stepping toward 10 and 2 rather than straight ahead. Valentine smelled the cordite on it. He hoped this particular one had killed the girl. Dots of blood decorated its face, a sticky pox. Old Father Wolf was proved right again. Enough hate and you felt no fear, just nervous anticipation.
Some prayers are answered. Look up and see.
Valentine knew better than to meet the Reaper's eyes. He waited for the knees to bend and rolled sideways, shoved the gun almost into the folds of its robe. Bullets wouldn't kill it, but the kinetic energy could sometimes stagger Reapers. It reacted aggressively, swung at his head with a scooping motion that would have sent his skull spinning like a field goal kick. Except Valentine was already behind it. He buried the pick end of his hand axe into its upper back, where the nerve trunks gathered on their way to the armored brain case. He got lung instead. It spun, jerking the handle of Valentine's pick out of his hands. Both opponents lurched off balance. Valentine restored his equilibrium first, dropped, and sighted under the jawline. The Reaper tore the pick free and ran. The fleeing Reaper held one hand in front of itself and the other holding its jaw. Valentine retrieved his pickaxe. It dived into the culvert beside the road and began to slither south at a pace he could just keep up with if he ran. The Kurian clearly wanted his puppet back, even with a string or two cut. Had it been willing to sacrifice its avatar, it could have chased him down and killed him, hunting by heartbeat if nothing else. Valentine paused in a tomato garden and calmed himself, tried to sense the emanations from the Reapers, caught a flicker off in the direction of the settlement garbage heap. He broke for the top of the low hill that kept the dump's sight and smell away from Nancy's. He got up just in time to see a truck pulling a horse trailer, turning onto a brush-choked access road. A cut-down Humvee with a toothy brush cutter on the front and a winged Southern Command battle star painted on its side led it down the road. You could pack a lot of Reapers in that trailer. An unpleasant surprise for the soldier who opened the door to check inside. The vehicles, driving without lights, if they still worked, disappeared. Valentine saw a man in camis with a scoped rifle slung across the handlebars of a dirt bike take off after the vehicles up the road. A cold wave passed over Valentine. Probably the sniper, tired and anxious after the operation, and listening to the sounds of his buddies driving off, hadn't been searching the hill line or the trees in the direction of Nancy's through his night sight. Had anyone in Nancy's called for help as the Reapers attacked? They arrived within a couple of hours, a thin string of cavalry on horseback, followed by more troops on mountain bikes, riding in a pair of lines on either side of the road. Valentine watched them the way a rancher might watch a cattle drive, making guesses as to health, morale, and training from everything from the condition of their boot heels to how they shaved their sideburns. Someone in Southern Command knew his business. Valentine guessed this to be a garrison from one of the supply depots supporting operations west of Tulsa. He sent Jules over to brief the captain in charge. They could radio to scouts around Tulsa. Even if the vehicles couldn't be intercepted, the scouts might be able to track them to whatever hidey hole they sought. The woman possessed an agile enough mind, and he could forgive a panic attack with a Reaper scratching at the door. Valentine helped collect bodies. The Reapers had struck hard and fast, over 100 deaths, and a handful more wounded who would probably die in the coming hours from assorted traumas. Shadows on the road. Valentine looked up, saw the captain with a corporal and three soldiers trailing behind, Jules bringing up the rear, probably going inside to find Nancy. He lifted the camphor-dipped bandana he kept over his face while moving bodies and covered his features, wishing he'd grabbed a hat. Jules looked anxious. Was the captain going to get another paragraph added to his cue file by bringing in an outlaw? Valentine went around to the other side of the cart and pushed a stiffened arm back under the awning.
Major Valentine?
Yes, Cap?
Sorry to disturb, Major.
Tonley! From the Razors. Captain Tonley now, by the look of it.
Recognized your walk, sir. Saw you going up toward the buildings.
Glad to see you again, and well. Or should I be?
No, Major. Nothing like that. I just wanted a chance to shake your hand.
Glad it's that way.
You thought...
Oh, hell no! Hell no, sir! Any sooner tries that, he'll have to walk back to the depot with his bike shoved up his ass.
I beg your pardon, Private? Sooner?
Oklahoma mounted. Mounted on bikes, that is. Get there sooner than the next guy.
Looks like you took a nasty left hook, Major.
Good guess.
Valentine left it unsaid that the pugilist had been a Reaper, hunting him and Gale Post in the hills of Kentucky. Valentine was invited to offer an opinion on tracking the Reaper-bearing vehicles, and the captain broke out his map. The party broke up within minutes, leaving Valentine with the feeling that he'd just got up from a long meal with old friends. Such was the nature of Southern Command's terrible, tasking comradeship.
Sorry about that. I tried to tell them it was some big mistake, but they insisted on talking to you. They told me they just wanted to shake hands, but Duvalier said...
It turned out all right. But you needn't have worried, even if it hadn't. I would have gone quietly. They're Southern Command's boys.
Meal break?
I won't feel like eating till tonight.
Oh, of course.
Mind if I ask you something, though?
You bet.
What was that about pregnancy last night? You're not expecting, are you?
I was scared. I had a close call a little while ago.
If I'd known you weren't on the pill, dumb chance to take last night.
It's a chance, all right.
I'm used to riddles from the Life Weavers or in the Kurian Zone, but not from fellow cats.
Can we go somewhere and talk?
All the liveliness had vanished from the bar. Its door had been torn from the hinges. One of the bartender girls scrubbed a stain on the floor, and the other's eyes were downcast and red. They had free lemon clear, a sour concoction posing as lemonade, thanks to the soldiers. Southern Command's forces had departed, the bikers down the road, and the horsemen cross-country. Before they'd left, they put tabs of lemon clear in 5-gallon plastic jugs of the local water. The medicine both killed bacteria and water parasites and gave it a mild flavor. They found a quiet corner out of hearing of the bartenders.
Get it out. You'll feel better.
It's like this. You know we can't find the Life Weavers, right?
I've heard rumors.
I feel like a creep. We should have just told you, but Allie said you'd have more fun the other way.
Told me what?
It's my way of, hopefully, becoming a cat. I know the Life Weavers do something to us, change our physical makeup somehow. They trigger a switch that's already inside us. That's the way it was explained to me, anyway.
Well, I don't think anyone really knows.
Like blood from bears, a transfusion heals stuff, practically makes a miracle. Or the way a couple of wolves have sex and their baby turns out able to smell really well. Seems like if Southern Command wants more hunters, it's up to the hunters to make them.
So we're being bred like foxhounds?
There's also the Dulcimet effect.
Never heard of that.
This doc, Dulcimet, with the Miskatonic, discovered it. He did this study on a cat from the Yazoo Delta who got a couple of teenagers pregnant. Women make better cats, generally, just like men make better bears. It turns out that when a woman is carrying a hunter's baby, sometimes it has an effect on the mother, since she and the baby sort of exchange blood while she's carrying. That's the Dulcimet effect.
So the idea is I get you pregnant, maybe you turn cat, and Southern Command gets another potential hunter in 9 months. What do they do with the baby?
Secret. They have to guard them from the Kurians. Anyway, there are only a couple of male cats. They've been looking for you for a while now, hoping that you'd get one of the volunteers pregnant.
Was it real volunteering, or are you being a good soldier?
Oh, it was real. Allie had me meet Stikes, Major Stiakowski. She painted quite a picture. Also, your rendezvous here was right for my cycle. They're keeping close track of that.
I suppose they have to.
It's been almost a day. Maybe we should give it another go. The more sperm, the better.
The Valier was right. Knowing probably will take a lot of the fun out of it.
Because the Free Territory and Kurian Zone find their lands subject to change of ownership and the occasional proposal to sit down and draw up peace plans meets only with ridicule, there are few well-defined borders. Even a widely acknowledged geographic obstacle such as the Mississippi River, serving as the unofficial eastern border of the UFR, is rather porous to penetration by small parties. David Valentine crossed it a number of times in the course of his duties as a wolf or cat. In the flats of the high, dry country around the Oklahoma Panhandle, there's no such divider. Only a depopulated strip, perhaps 50 miles wide, where farming settlements emptied over the summer of 2074, once the locals learned that the UFR would advance no further. The region between the Kurian and UFR watchpoints is the home of rabbit, coyotes, and hawks, surveyed by high-flying gargoyles during the day and aura-sensing reapers at night. Remnants of the cash crops of the region, wheat, soy, sorghum, and barley, can still be found growing wild, sometimes grazed down by small herds of wild sheep and wily, testy goats. The old interstate, shooting east-west through the flat with a bend here and there placed by engineers to keep motorists from growing hypnotized by the road, still sees a convoy every week or so. The Kurians allow the traffic so that their favored supporters might have luxuries brought in from far away, with the thrilling but harmless taint of black market goods, and the Free Territory needs the gear and medicines the inevitable smuggling compartments contain. The third winner in the arrangement is the road patrols, who inevitably take away a bottle of liquor or a carton of cigarettes as they carry out everything from fugitive searches to safety inspections on the road traffic. David Valentine waited quietly in the backseat of the Land Rover, watching the checkpoint soldiers inspect the convoy behind. The convoy had pulled off the road in the vast empty plains at a watchtower-flanked checkpoint, the first and most important on their ride through the southwest, according to the driver. A slight ridge, thick with spring prairie flowers, was noticeable only because the rest of the topography was so flat. Valentine's Overwatch car was the second of the string of 19 vehicles in the convoy, not counting the motorcycles riding at the head and tail. Road Chief Lautenberg, a good friend of the Hobarth clan, signed on Max Argent when his convoy stopped for an overnight at Nancy's. The stolid Lautenberg, so phlegmatic he might be mistaken for one of the uniformed dummies that filled out the real warriors in the big army truck at the center of the convoy, had looked him up and down with his one good eye and assigned him to one of the combat teams. At first, Valentine rode guard with the back team, a group of drivers in an armored minibus who slept or played cards while they waited to replace others when they came off shift. After he brought down a buck grazing in a field from 250 yards at dawn, Lautenberg transferred him to the Overwatch Rover. The Rover was a high-clearance four-wheel drive, panels long since replaced by welded corrugated aluminum and old bulletproof vests. It had thick off-road tires, spotlights, a winch, and a cupola, complete with bullet shield and a venerable heavy machine gun called the Poker. Its sights were made of carved reaper teeth and wire. Valentine patted his gun in its bracket on the back of the driver's seat. Stiakowski had answered his request for a reliable, accurate, but not threatening-looking carbine with her usual precision. She'd shown up with a Steyr Scout Viper, a deadly little killer with a forward-mounted scope, flash suppressor, and 18-round mini-drum feeding the oversized bolt action. They'd supplied him with four boxes of ammunition for it, and a special little five-bullet leather holder. A note accompanied them from a weapons researcher at the Miskatonic. He explained that the five shells were a new experimental delivery method for Quickwood, suspending a distillate of the sap in a capsule that would be broken as the armor-piercing bullet fragmented, hopefully inside a Reaper. The note had ended with a request for Valentine to let the researcher know whether the results were good or bad. He wondered at that. If the results were bad, Valentine probably wouldn't live to share his feedback. New steel-tipped hiking boots, a hard frame pack, thermal underwear, a bamboo sleeping mat, a thick wool scarf, leather gloves, mittens, a compass, and survival gear filled out the rest of the footlocker she'd brought. Stiakowski had also provided him with a thick nylon laborer's girdle that could be popped open to reveal 24 gold coins. Resting in sawdust padding were six bottles of bourbon and a mini telescope. Nothing had any tagging or labeling to identify it as originating with Southern Command. Even his ammunition was in Kansas City's zero-load boxes, one of the biggest armorers in the Midwest. Best of all, she'd found his sword. He'd asked for a similar blade to the one he'd carried on his first mission as a cat, never expecting for his original to show up, sharpened and in a new stiffened black leather sheath. Who knew what warehouse it had rested in since the day he, Duvalier, and Anka left for his long mission into the Kurian Zone in search of a half-legendary weapon to defeat the Reapers that turned out to be Quickwood? Ostensibly, the convoy carried pumping equipment, high-voltage cable, machine tools, and a dozen other industrial necessities. But behind the heavy equipment that required a forklift or crane rested cases of sealed black label bourbon, boxes of chocolate, jewelry, furs, and precision optics. An officer with a red pillbox hat, thick with Kurian service pins, stuck his head in the window, examining Valentine's profile, then turned to the heavyset commander of the Overwatch car.
I need that man out, please. Cuff him for now.
Okay, boss.
Valentine's back went clammy. Had a wanted poster made it into the Southwest? He could confuse the issue for a few days with his false IDs, but capture would mean...
Get out, Max. The girls here want to look into those pretty brown eyes.
You ever go by the name David Valentine, Chief?
No, sir. Don't know him.
I didn't say if you knew him.
Sorry, sir.
Lautenberg walked up, moving at a pace just short of a trot, his lead rig driver just behind. He approached the officer in the pillbox hat.
What now, Hopgood? We're detaining one of your men so we can run some prints. He fits a description. Indianish, black hair, scarred, about the right height and weight.
Detain? Now how long's that gonna take?
A day or two at most. You can move on.
Argent, you wanted for something.
Some guy named Valentine. All red men heap look alike, Road Chief.
Well, this convoy isn't leaving a man behind.
Up to you. Bring the wagon. We'll take him to Blackwater Holy.
The hell you are! Hopgood, I've been easy on you because you're new, and I don't like making enemies. But wouldn't it be kind of dumb for some fugitive to pass right through one spot he's sure to be looked at?
Yeah, this guy's clever. He took out a whole regiment of TMCC and blew that big Mississippi grog cannon into orbit.
Yeah, well, that'd be news to his mother, because until she passed, Max here was taking care of her every day of his life. Kansas militia trusted him with a gun, I know that. My Ingrid's married to Tom Stormcloud over in Topeka. He's Stormcloud's cousin.
Valentine had no idea what spring this torrent of bullshit was coming from, but it fitted his faked papers like a jigsaw piece. Lautenberg had just glanced at them briefly back at Nancy's.
Now, you can detain this kid. I can wait here, getting madder and madder every hour. And when General Cox in Albuquerque runs out of Black Label bourbon and has to listen to those three coochies of his bitch about how they're all out of lipstick and undies, well, I just might call you a bad name or two when he asks what was keeping me. You ever talk to Cox when he's bone dry on whiskey? Your man, Corporal Guadalco, smoked three cigarettes with Max here last October. The corporal even showed him a picture of his kids.
I'll cut him loose this time, Lautenberg, but your reputation's riding on this.
My reputation's riding on about 300 tires. I just want them spinning again.
Thank you, sir.
Smile, Hoppy. Have a cigar. You road rangers know I'm just trying to get from A to B and back to A. Smuggling fugitives doesn't come between A and B. Or A and Z, for that matter. It's a whole nother alphabet.
Yeah. Move out.
It'll be my pleasure. Mount up!
The scout cycles led the pack, then the combat craft. The big tow trucks, capable of pulling a disabled truck or moving an unexpected obstacle with their thick cable winches, the money trucks with the tanker and chuck wagon RV, guarded by a truck full of dummy soldiers, a few gypsy vans traveling with the convoy for protection like pilot fish hovering close to a shark, more cargo trucks, then the rear guard, the remount truck, and more cycles.
The Spikes must really have it in for that Valentine fella.
By Spikes, the Overwatch car commander meant the Kurians. Their towers did look a little like Spikes, glimpsed from a distance. He had thoughtful eyes and a patchy beard. The rest of the car, Zuniga at the wheel and Swell at the ring gun, called their commander Salsa. He spread hot sauce from an endless supply of tiny red bottles he kept in a machine gun belt case on everything he ate, save fruit.
Nice of the road chief to stand up for me. I was in a cell once before. Thought I'd cashed out.
What were you in for?
Fighting in public drunkenness.
That where you got your face rearranged?
Yep.
Swell ducked his head down from the ring gun. He loved riding in the wind, leaning on the canvas-covered poker, but always wanted details of in-cab conversations shouted up to him.
What are you guys talking about?
We're talking about how your mother undercuts all the other whores. I swear to God, I should make him drive so he doesn't miss nothing.
No way! Feels way too cooped up in there!
Salsa winked at Valentine as he tied Swell's shoelaces together. And with that, David Valentine passed out of Oklahoma. April was a beautiful time of year in the Southwest. The forests, whose trees felt spaced out and airy compared with the thickets of the Ozarks, were cool and breezy, and the dry grasses of the range country were bright with flowers, yellows and pinks and blues that attracted butterflies. Sadly, many of the latter ended up in gooey, colorful pieces on the windshield and grill of the 4x4. The convoy had pulled off into a lonely road stop outside Albuquerque, where Kurians, who were at odds with the rest of the Aztlan Confederation, were famous for letting strangers enter but not leave. The road chief had avoided towns in general as they crossed New Mexico. Towns brought local police to the vehicles like thirsty ticks looking for blood. New Universal Church missions and monasteries provided safety of another sort, but the churchmen in their tube steel clerical collars, grades of metal differentiated just what the ascetics had given up to more fully devote themselves to the betterment of mankind, were a more hygienic and annoying version of the lawmen. At least the lawmen didn't subject one to lectures about reproductive responsibilities as they took their graft. Lautenberg had called all car commanders together for a briefing. Valentine watched as Salsa returned from the meeting.
Scouts are reporting some burned rigs in Holloway Valley. Probably the Jaguars.
Jaguars?
They wear bits of fur. A successful warrior gets mountain lion skin or wolf. The lowlifes have to make do with coyote. They're half wild, worship those reaper monoliths you see in this part of the country. They ain't after our cargo or gear, just our giblets. They think if they take lives, drink blood, they become as strong as the Reapers. Or turn into them.
Valentine searched the copper-dusted mountains of the Mogollon Rim ahead. The dry air gave the horizon a clarity that seemed to expand his personal patch of Earth as it reduced his place in it. He felt rather like one of the valley butterflies, perhaps determinedly unaware of an approaching windshield.
Will they keep off us?
Depends. Some of the young men might be feeling their oats. Wish I could tell you more. All we got to go on is rumor. No one's lived in Hollow Eye Valley long enough to do any social studies.
I didn't see that on the road map.
It's unofficial. Like, checkpoint circle jerk back there.
So what's the plan?
Sounds like the Jaguars have the road blocked good with wrecks. They ain't manning the barricade. But somebody launched off some slingstones at the bikers while they were checking the area out. We're going to go in and cover the wreckers while they clear the road.
When?
Now. While we still have daylight.
Could they tell how they took out the wrecks?
Looked like a big road accident, they said. No question, one vehicle blew up. I had dynamite lobbed at me a couple runs back when I was driving the tanker. Maybe they got lucky with a toss.
How many dead did the scouts find?
They said it was a dozen at least. They're not even dried out yet.
With two motorcycles riding scout, flanking the operation like prowling dogs under the perfect yellow of an Arizona sun, the two wreckers and Salsa's armed 4x4 approached the blockade at a creep. Valentine hung out one door by a safety strap, searching the road for signs of mining. Salsa did the same, from a slightly more conventional position in the passenger window. Valentine caught the stench of burning tires from the blockade ahead.
Okay, Argent. Go earn your coin. Seniority has its privileges.
Valentine trotted up the median of the highway with carbine held ready against his shoulder. There was precious little cover on the road itself, and if he had to go to ground, he at least wanted the dry-looking brush in between him and the Jaguars. The eight bodies were laid out between the wrecks in a pattern that might have been trying to be a flower or a boat propeller. All were hollow-socketed and opened at the ribcage. Valentine guessed that the heart and liver were missing at least, along with more obvious extractions of eyes, noses, and tongues. He knelt beside one sandy-haired corpse and looked in the nose. They'd spooned out a good deal of brain as well. Valentine hopped up in a pickup bed. The contents had been stripped as hastily and messily as the bodies, and saw one of the bikers with a shouldered assault rifle aiming at a running, sun-browned figure. The runner had a bad limp, with blood and dirt caked on his leg. The biker slung his AR-15 and reached behind himself on the bike, lifting an oddly thick rifle. He pumped the action. Valentine saw a thick dart blossom in the back of the runner. Somehow the Jaguar rose again, a thin spear lodged in a grooved thrower. Valentine brought up the stire and sighted on the dark blotch of armpit hair under the Jaguar's raised right arm. Valentine watched the misthrown spear change trajectory from straight up to straight down. The biker gunned his bike for the spot where the Jaguar fell. He raised himself in the saddle and bumped over the body in a figure-eight pattern, making sure this time. Valentine scanned the countryside, wondering if the wounded warrior had been sacrificed to draw the biker into a trap, but no other threats emerged from the brush and cacti. With the killing that couldn't quite be labeled a skirmish over, Valentine waved the wreckers forward. Valentine had pulled the bodies one by one off the road, lining them up in the median. When the corpses were lined up, he had loosened some soil with the pick end of his worm hook and thrown loose dirt over the butchered collection. Swell stood by the Land Rover, watching.
You don't mean to bury all those bodies?
I do.
Hell, man. The birds and coyotes will take care of them with a lot less sweat.
The biker who had chased after the Jaguar, a lean, greasy-haired man who looked as though he'd crossed New Mexico dragged by the bike rather than in the saddle, shook his head at Swell, then strode into the median and held his hand out to Valentine.
I'll help. Name's Loring. Zeb Loring.
Max Argent. Mucho gusto.
Hey, yup.
Never met a Zeb before. That short for Zebulon?
My father never made it much past Genesis in the Bible. Mom was a rabbi out of New York. It was a compromise.
You're a long way from the east.
Hey, yep. You too, looks like. Those are Kentucky legworm leathers.
That they are.
I always thought those beasties were grand. You don't have to feed them gas and oil.
Ever rode one?
Nah, too slow. I like to be on something that could outrun those damn golems.
I hear you.
Hey, look at that. Oh, I bet Denver got hit again. That's the Flying Circus. They range all over the Southwest, set up temporary airfields on old roads.
Valentine shaded his eyes. The aircraft were bunched in three groups, flying high toward the Southwest. He guessed that they were above 10,000 feet.
Pip's Flying Circus.
Yeah, that's what they're called. I saw a couple of them in their fancy leathers in a bar in Nogales once. Yep, they're not ones for staying put either.
What are you gonna do when we hit L.A.?
Celebrate. Then we might head up the valley to wine country. They do a few runs a year over the mountains to the Missouri and Arkansas riverheads. Good money, garden wine. And a flask out of the supply cask can really make dinner an experience.
More of a beer man myself.
To each his own. Shit. Looks like someone's in trouble up there.
Valentine marked a twin-engine plane, a dirty clay color with a red stripe going up the tail like a hockey stick. It spewed white vapor from one engine and faint black puffs from the other as it passed overhead. The plane gained altitude, trying for the mountains to the west. Valentine watched as it shrank to a cross in the distance.
Oh, he's in trouble now.
That poor dumb bastard.
He should have set it down in the road by us.
He must have been trying to make it to his home airfield.
Are those the guys with the reward message on the backs of their jackets?
Tempting, isn't it? But forget it. The Jaguars will have him by dark.
How long would it take us to get to where he landed?
I ain't even guesstimating. We're not risking the rover.
Then I'll go on foot.
And what about your contract, Argent?
I got the option breaking it.
You don't get paid then.
I'd appreciate an extra canteen and some of the freeze-dry if you could spare that at least.
Valentine got his gun, sword, and pack, and tucked in a few extra odds and ends from the rover's supplies. Freeze-dried veggie packs, about as appetizing as a bathroom mat, but full of vitamins, beef sticks, dried fruit. He felt the strange clarity that came over him sometimes, the one that infected him when he went into Chicago after Molly, or struck off into the Nebraska sandhills to warn the Trekkers against the General, or pushed him to save a wounded Grog who would become his best friend. Valentine felt his eyes go wet at the memory of Anka, and that told him he was doing the right thing. Sergeant Patel used to talk about a third eye capable of perceiving the invisible. Valentine wondered if there was a third ear, hearing the whispers of guardian angels. Loring pulled his bike up next to him as Valentine marked a reference point for the fallen aircraft.
Sounds like a bad idea, Argent. You sure about this?
I am. Interested in making a Troy?
I'm not parking three butts on my bike for an off-road trip to Neverland.
I just want you to get me to that airplane.
Let's see the color of your gold.
Valentine reached into his belt and palmed out one of his coins.
Hey, this isn't some fancy plan to get me out so you can debit my bike.
I arranged for the plane to go down just so I could get your ride.
Right. Sorry. Paranoid is the best way to stay alive when you're on the road for a living.
No offense. Salsa, give my regards to Lautenberg. I'll either meet you guys tomorrow when you run the valley or dog southwest.
You a crusader, Argent, or just greedy?
Little both.
I can appreciate that. Hang your pack there. You can put the gun and the giblet prodder on the front rack if you like. Hop on.
Let's ride.